Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast. I'm your host, Ted Knightsky. So, everybody has kind of like their author, right? Kind of like your band. You know, my favorite band is U2, one of my favorite singers, Peter Gabriel, but like Daniel Pink, Malcolm Gladwell, Brené Brown. Those are three authors that like right off the bat. If they come out with a new book, I've got to have it. Well, Daniel Pink was first on that list for a reason. I've been reading his stuff for years, following his blog, following him on Twitter, but I've been reading his books for a long time. And I got in the habit a long time ago of when Daniel Pink would come out with a new book, I would save that book for spring break. Now, what I would do is I would bring that book to spring break and sit in the warm sun and love it. Love every part of it. You see, Daniel Pink writes with a voice of discovery. And when you read his books, like you feel like a kid learning things for the first time, and he will bring things to your attention in ways that change you. And he changed me as a father, as a husband, as a friend, as an educator, as a business person, as a nonprofit leader. But most of all, he changed me because of his leadership, because Daniel Pink is someone who has great influence over many people because of the way in which he discovers things and then prints them. So this interview was like the privilege of a lifetime. Last summer, Daniel Pink had come to a conference that we had put on, and he was our keynote speaker, and I had the privilege of speaking to him for about 40 minutes and asking him all different types of questions. And this is a recording of that conversation. Enjoy.
Welcome to the Smart Thinking Podcast, Mr. Pink. We're pretty excited to have you here with us today, and I'm wondering if you could just start out by telling us a little bit about where you grew up and family and education.
Where I grew up in Columbus, Ohio, where I went to, my family and I lived about two blocks away from a local public school, and it was small enough that I basically took the same walk to school for 11 years. I moved to this neighborhood when I was in second grade, so the school had the elementary school was in one building. The junior high was on the second floor of that building, and the high school was in the building next door. So I took the same walk to school for 11 years. I went to college, where I majored in linguistics, a very mathematical form of social science, and then I got a law degree a few years after that. So that is my quote unquote formal education.
And when you were in elementary, middle, and high school, any influential teachers that you reflect back upon when you're back in the old neighborhood or find yourself thinking about?
Yeah, when I was in high school, I had a journalism teacher who was quite good. And, you know, what was really good about her is that she pretty much let me do my own thing in terms of working in the newspaper and pursuing my own kinds of stories and things like that. And I probably learned more about writing from working on the high school newspaper than I did from any of my actual classes.
What kinds of things did you learn from that teacher when you were writing for the paper?
Well, I mean, I think that it wasn't so much, you know, it's interesting that when we think about the influence of teachers, because, you know, a lot of times we think, well, that a teacher influenced us because he or she, you know, directly imparted certain specific kinds of wisdom. And I think in this case, at least in my case, it was really this teacher established a context in which I could be documented and learn stuff on my own. And so it wasn't the kind of thing, it was the kind of thing where if I said, hey, I'd like to do a story about X, Y, or Z, she wouldn't say, no, that's a bad idea. We don't do stories about that. She'd say, that sounds good. Maybe approach it this way. And so it was really, you know, a teacher as a guide and a setter of context rather than a teacher who is directly, explicitly imparting lessons and knowledge.
Well, and I think you've written about this as well, but the greatest power of a teacher isn't necessarily the facts and figures and skills they're going to impart on you. But to your point, it's the kind of Sherpa effect of standing in front of you and giving you what you need when you need a pull and giving you a push
exactly.
From behind. So tell me, what is your favorite high school story that you ever wrote?
Let's see here. I think that, well, it's interesting. The one I remember the most, because it actually was a learning experience and there was a little bit of a battle about it, was a story where it was actually about the basketball team at the high school and the star player having been suspended for a break-in and how to deal with that. So how to interview the coach about that, because it's something that he wasn't very comfortable talking about, and also how to render it in the article. And I remember having some battles on that. And so that was the one that to me is most memorable. Most of the stuff that I wrote as a 17-year-old, I've understandably and thankfully forgotten.
Well, my claim to fame was I wrote a story about where the homecoming queen got her hair done before homecoming, and I remember the whole...
Nice. Well, that's good. That's good reporting. People want to know that.
I remember the whole time thinking, like, who cares? And then, like, when it came out, all the people in town started to go to the same lady because the homecoming queen went there, but...
Wow.
Yeah, good times. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, post-law school. How do you start to write? Because... where do you get the idea of, you know, I want to be a writer, a researcher. I want to change things. What's that pathway look like for the kids and staff who are going to listen to this?
It's a great question. And I think there is a lesson here of sorts. It's a lesson that made sense to me only in retrospect. It wasn't a lesson that I followed and then, you know, followed the path of this lesson to a particular destination. It was a path that revealed itself retrospectively, and it was this. And forgive me if I'll try to make the story as succinct as possible. But as you mentioned, I did go to law school, and upon leaving law school, instead of practicing law, I started working in politics, working at a number of jobs in campaigns and those kinds of things, and in a kind of indirect, unplanned way, became a political speechwriter. But what happened was, and I was very interested in politics, what happened was that after several years of doing that, I became less and less, like the more time I spent in politics, the less interested in it I became, which is not a good sign. Yeah. And so I finally decided to leave, after, I don't know, 6 or 7 years of doing that. And in terms of what I could do next, I came to the realization of what I should do next in a peculiar way, and it came like this. From the time that I was in college, I was always writing on the quote-unquote on the side. So, for instance, in college, I was a social science major, fairly serious student, fairly hardcore, intense analytical student. But I also ended up writing short stories and actually won a short story prize, even though I would be like the least likely person, you know, superficially to participate in writing a story, a short story, fictional short story. When I was working, when I went to law school, when I was in law school, I was quote unquote writing on the side. I would write newspaper articles and early newspaper columns and magazine articles. When I was actually in the workplace, in some of these very demanding jobs, I was quote unquote writing on the side. I was writing magazine columns. I was writing magazine articles. And it got to the point where certain jobs that I had, I wasn't even permitted to be paid for these things because of federal ethics rules. Hmm. And yet I was, and so essentially what happened was that, you know, if, you know, I'm in my early, I'm not like a child, I'm in my early 30s, I'm married, and I'm in this tiny apartment in the Adams Morgan section of Washington, D.C. with my wife, and I have a very demanding job. But it's midnight, and I'm on the computer writing an article that I'm not getting paid for. And so, you know, my wife helped me figure out, hey, look at what you're doing here. You're taking on another obligation in the midst of a very demanding job, and you're not even getting paid for it. I think you might like doing this. And so what I discovered, I guess, the lesson of all of this is that as much as people tell us to follow your passion, I don't really like that advice. I find that daunting, like to figure out what your passion is.
Right.
But I do think that there's a lesson here in asking yourself, what do you do? That is, like, what do you do just because of what it's who you are No one's telling you to do it. No one's necessarily even paying you for it. But what do you do because it's something that it's a pursuit that you find meaningful, challenging, fulfilling, or whatever? And it turned out that basically took me all this time. I mean, literally from the time that maybe I was 18 to the time that I was in my early 30s to realize that this thing that I was doing, quote unquote, on the side was really like what I did. And so that's how I came to doing what I'm doing now. And that's the lesson that I derived from it, which is asking yourself, what do you do, rather than asking yourself, what's my passion?
I really love your point there about the passion, because it's not just a burden, it's a weight. You know, when you tell you know, I've got a high school son, and you know, I see all this pressure on him, you know, tell us what your major is going to be. Where are you going to, you know, what are you going to do when you grow up?
Right.
He's 16 years old. Like, what do you like? And he's taking assessments and Gallup strength finders and all this stuff. And every time I just feel like poor guy's just got to find his way, and we got to figure out how to get him there. So that's a really good point.
Exactly.
So you talk about discovery, Dan, and one of the things that, I'm sure you get this feedback, but the way you write is what we teach kids in middle school and high school is called voice, or voice of author. And your voice is always one of discovery. Like, I look forward to when your books come out, because I feel like when I read your books, like, I hear your passion, but more importantly, I feel like if I were to stop at your house randomly and sit down for a beer or or dinner, like, you and I, you have this like trivial approach of discovery, like, oh my God. And then I learned today that you should, you know, drink caffeine before you nap. Who would think? And you parlay that into a book. So what are some of the ways in which those discoveries have correlated into great excitement? And more importantly, like, what is one of the discoveries that you just can never get past? Like, what's one of your favorite things that you've learned in your research and your writing?
Well, in the latest book, When, about science and timing, there's all kinds of stuff that I learned. And, you know, there's not a single finding that really blew me away. There are multiple ones. So for instance, at a broad level, in this latest book, I was really just blown away by just the mere idea that our cognitive abilities, our brain power, doesn't stay the same throughout the day. And that to me was a revelation, because in my own work, you know, sometimes I feel better at certain times of the day and other times of the day. And I just thought that, oh, well, you know, times that I'm not feeling as sharp, I've got to work harder, I've got to man up. And it turned out that, no, that's just how human beings are. Our cognitive abilities don't stay the same throughout the day. But then there are other ones as well. So, for instance, I was really surprised by this research on when you're giving good news and bad news, what do you give first? And it turns out that I always gave the good news first in a good news, bad news scenario. And it turned out that's the wrong way to do it. That human beings prefer endings that elevate, and they prefer rising sequences at the end to declining sequences at the end. And therefore, you should always give the bad news first. So that changed the way I look at things. There's another really interesting study on gift certificates, of all things, that showed that you take two groups of people, you give half of them, you give all of them a gift certificate, but they have different rules. So half of them get a gift certificate that expires in 3 weeks. Half of them get a gift certificate that expires in 2 months. And it turns out that the group that had less time is more likely to cash in the gift certificate. The idea that by a large margin, that groups that had 3 weeks to cash in the gift certificate cashed in the gift certificate five times as much as groups that had 2 months, which makes no sense.
Right.
But what it taught me is that if you want people to do something, many times short fuses are better than long fuses. And so at some level, I mean, I think your intuition is very good. That's why I like doing what I do, is that you get to find out stuff like this. And so the process and the result of discovering these kinds of insights is exhilarating.
Well, and I'll tell you, so I read your book right after it came out, and we were, the Knightsky family goes on summer road trips that we try to line up with our kids' curriculum. And I was always thinking, like, you know, so when we drive, you know, when you've got a 14-hour ride home or something, it's just, it's horrible. And after I read your book, I actually shifted the way in which we did our trip so that we ended on, like, a much more exciting thing. Because I think most people are like, okay, so when we get there, we're going to go whitewater rafting, and then we're going to go to this place. And then when we end, we'll go to a museum and maybe some books because people will be tired. And I flipped it around. I'm like, all right, boring stuff up front, exciting stuff at the end. And what's ironic is when you talk to my kids, they're like, oh man, that was the best trip we've ever taken. I'm thinking like, what?
Interesting.
So you're right in there. So a couple more questions here real quick. So one of the things that, you know, as a school superintendent and a teacher for me, I find myself in environments where, you know, I might be in a concert watching a high school orchestra, and I'll lean to the person next to me and say, can you believe we're getting paid to be here? And I find, again, like in your book, you're doing that. So I'm guessing that in your life, once in a while, you find yourself in some pretty unbelievable situations. And I have something that keeps me humble where I always think back to, if I went back to my fourth grade self and said, hey, someday you're going to get to do these things, my fourth grade self would probably punch me and run away. But what would be some of the things that you'd say to your fourth grade self? Because it wouldn't be immodest, like, hey, you're going to get to do this, and this is amazing. What are some of those life experiences for Dan Pink?
Oh, I mean, basically, there are almost too many to enumerate. You know, I've just had a good fortune of just visiting a lot of places and doing some interesting work. And, you know, as a fourth grader, you know, I was especially for a boy, was a reader. And so the idea that later on, I would actually write a book and it would be in the library and it would have its own Dewey Decimal number would have blown me away.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, totally.
PIN. So what do you see other people responding from your readings? Like, what do you hear when people come up to you and say, hey, I did this as a result? Or what are some of those humbling things for you?
That's another good point. I mean, it varies from book to book, but it always amazes. See, I still am amazed that anybody actually reads anything that I write. And so that's kind of surprising and gratifying to me. And then if somebody reads something that I wrote and actually changes their life a little bit, that keeps me in the writing business a little bit longer. So I wrote a book called A Whole New Mind about the rise of artistic empathic thinking in a world that's easy to outsource and automate routine tasks. And I've had a lot of people come and say, oh my gosh, I read this book and now I understand why my son wants to be a designer, or now I understand why my daughter wants to do graphical user interfaces rather than become a pure computer programmer. And, you know, that's exciting. It's fun.
Well, I'll tell you, so that you bring up that text, that when you brought that, when that book came out, I was a middle school principal. I read the book while on spring break in Florida in an afternoon. And by the end of the trip, I had like recreated our entire professional development plan for our staff.
Oh my God. Okay, there you go.
Yeah. And we had
another example like that. That comment right there will keep me in the writing business for about two more weeks.
See, and it's cheap fuel, right? So our whole staff read that. I will tell you what, when our teachers were reading that, the younger teachers were like, oh my gosh, this is so exciting. Look at all the things we can do. And kind of the people in the middle of their career were like, these are some great opportunities for me to adjust my practice. And then there were people who, you know, on the back nine of their career who sat there with this sullen look on their face. And I said, you know, like, what's wrong? And what you just pointed out, they're like, for 25 years, I have been making it all about this way and this way only. And now here I learn that, you know, this isn't just crazy science, but it's true. And that, again, not that you need the compliments, but that's your voice of discovery in your writing and how it shifts people. So I don't know. I love it.
And well, thanks for that. I appreciate that. You've kept me in the business a little bit longer.
So what's your next project? What are you working on? Because there's no way you're sitting still.
Well, I'm trying to figure that out, and so I have a pretty high bar for books that I write because it takes, you know, it's just so much work to write a book. It takes so long and it's so consuming that it's, to me at least, it's essential to pick something that a topic you're absolutely mesmerized by, and that is, most topics are not that way. and it can be seductive in a way. Like there are a lot of topics that are kind of sort of, you know, that are fairly interesting. And the thing is, but if you take something that's only fairly interesting and you commit to the intensity that is writing a book, it's going to be, you're going to be miserable. So you have to find something that is, that you're really deeply, deeply, deeply curious about and care about a great deal, because you're going to live with it for a very, very, very long time. I still get calls and emails about, you know, my first book, which I wrote, which came out 17 years ago, you know?
Right.
And so I spend a lot of time vetting ideas to make sure that I find something that is really, really compelling. And so I'm vetting ideas right now.
Well, and I was nerding out here for a second. I'm a history teacher and I was a history major. So I always spend my time in the end notes. And when I look at your end notes, I think to myself, what does your den or office look like?
You know, my office is actually not that chaotic. It's not pristine, but it's not as piles and piles of papers as you would think. I'm actually a pretty anal retentive filer. So I have a lot of old fashioned file folders and paper stuffed in there. And I think what you might be more horrified would be what my Dropbox looks like. So I have probably 130 folders in Dropbox that help me organize my life. So, no one needs to see that.
No, but that's one of the things, to your point, you know, in your process of writing a book, it's not easy. And the volume of stuff that you have to collect and you're reading, and again, it comes out in your discovery as you're writing your chapters. I'm sure it's that way in that perfectionist process. But so my last question for you is, what is a good day for Daniel Pink?
A good day for me is in the morning, getting some writing done. For me, I'm a pretty slow writer, so momentum matters a lot to me. So showing up on a Monday and getting some good words out, and then on a Tuesday and getting some good words out, Wednesday getting some good words out. So for me, a good day is basically, get some good writing done in the morning. Do a little bit of the administrative stuff in the early afternoon, maybe do a couple of interviews and things in the later afternoon, go for a run late afternoon, early evening, and then have dinner with my family, and then, you know, read at night. So it's a pretty, not exactly a rock star life, but that works for me.
Those are pretty good problems, though. That's a great day. And what are you reading right now?
Wow, I'm reading all kinds of stuff. At the moment, I'm reading a book called There, There. It's a novel by a fellow named Tommy Orange, about a pretty interesting book about Indians, Native Americans who live in urban areas, like in this case, Oakland. It's a work of fiction. Just read a nice work of fiction called Convenience Store Woman, about a woman who worked at a convenience store in Japan. It's a really, really great book. And then nonfiction, I guess the last thing that I read was, I think, Bad Blood, which is by John Carreyrou, about the scandal with Theranos, the company in Silicon Valley that claimed that it had a revolutionary blood testing technology, but turned out to be a gigantic, epic,
oh yes,
insidious fraud. It's a great book.
Yeah. So my last thing I just wanted to ask you real quick, because of who our audience is what advice, based upon your learnings and your experience as a parent and everything else, do you have for educators?
I think that, you know, for educators and for all of us, you know, our starting premises matter a lot. And you see some interesting research about this. So I think that what we should do is that, you know, our starting premises about the people we work with or about the people we teach should be that people want to be active and engaged and are capable of doing great things. So if you start with that premise, I think you often, not always at all, but you often will get people will actually rise to those presumptions. If you start with the other presumption, that people are lazy, shiftless, want to be controlled, need to be controlled or else they'll slack, I think that leads you down one path. So I've become more convinced on the power of starting premises. So if you start, some people will disprove it. You won't be right about everybody. But if you start with the premise that people are active and engaged and want to contribute and want to do great work, I think that leads you down a far more promising path than the other premise.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, thank you for taking the time to join me on this. And I really, really appreciate this. And like always, I will look forward to hearing your voice of discovery in your newest writings.
Well, thanks so much. You're very kind. Thanks for having me on the podcast.
Awesome.
So let's do some smart thinking. Based upon what you heard today, how can you apply your new knowledge to serve those that you serve? Describe strategies that you can immediately employ to improve your personal life, your children's lives, and those that you serve. And finally, who should read this book and how can you get it to them? That's it. That's the Smart Thinking Podcast. As always, thank you for listening. Please feel free to share this on your social media platform and help me help others in my mission of growing greater leadership. Also, thank you to Daniel Pink for taking the time to chat with me about all these cool things. And thank you to the Wellpennies for their awesome music. This episode was sparked by a really unique opportunity I had last year to bring Daniel Pink in to speak to over 400 leaders from across our region. He was an incredible speaker, thought-provoking, and again, my favorite thing about him is his ability to just, through his own word choice, create a sense of awe and discovery in his writing and his voice while he writes. Take time to read this book. It's called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing by Daniel Pink, and watch yourself as you change how you apply your leadership skills for others, and use his information to advocate not for what's easy, but what's right.
Won't you take my hand and shake the world with me? There's a song arising, just you wait and see. Won't you take my hand and shake the world with me? Shake the world with me. Shake the world with me.